Chapter 10, Tibetan Beliefs. It may be of some interest to give here some details of our way of life. Our religion is a form of Buddhism, but there is no word which can be transliterated. We refer to it as the religion, and to those of our faith as insiders. Those of other beliefs are termed outsiders. The nearest word already known in the West is Lamaism. It departs from Buddhism in that ours is a religion of hope and a belief in the future. Buddhism to us seems negative, a religion of despair. We certainly do not think that an all-seeing Father is watching and guarding everyone, everywhere. Many learned people have passed erudite comment on our religion. Many of them have condemned us because they were blinded by their own faith and could see no other point of view. Some have even called us satanic, because our ways are alien to them. Most of these writers have based their opinions on hearsay or on the writings of others. Possibly very few have studied our beliefs for a few days and have then felt competent to know all, to write books on the subject, and to interpret and make known that which it takes our cleverest sages a lifetime to discover. Imagine the teachings of a Buddhist or Hindu who had flipped through the pages of the Christian Bible for an hour or two and then tried to explain all the subtler points of Christianity. None of these writers on Lamaism has lived as a monk in a lamasery from early boyhood and studied the sacred books. These books are secret because they are not available to those who want quick, effortless, and cheap salvation. Those who want the solace of some ritual, some form of self-hypnosis, can have it if it will help them. It is not the inner reality, but childish self-deception. To some, it may be very comforting to think that sin after sin can be committed, and then, when the conscience prods too much, a gift of some kind to the nearest temple will so overwhelm the gods with gratitude that forgiveness will be immediate, all-embracing, and certain, and will enable one to indulge in a fresh set of sins. There is a God, a supreme being. What does it matter what we call him? God is a fact. Tibetans who have studied the true teachings of Buddha never pray for mercy or for favors, but only that they may receive justice from man. A supreme being, as the essence of justice, cannot show mercy to one and not to another, because to do so would be a denial of justice. To pray for mercy or for favors, promising gold or incense if the prayer is answered, is to imply that salvation is available to the highest bidder, that God is short of money and can be bought. Man can show mercy to man, but very rarely does. The Supreme Being can show only justice. We are immortal souls. Our prayer, Om Mani Padme Hum, which is written below, is often translated literally as Hail to the Jewel of the Lotus. We who have gone a little further know that the true meaning is Hail to Man's Over-Self. There is death, As one doffs one's clothes at the end of day, so does the soul doff the body when the latter sleeps. As a suit of clothes is discarded when worn out, so does the soul discard the body when the latter is worn or torn. Death is birth. Dying is merely the act of being born in another plane of existence. Man, or the spirit of man, is eternal. The body is but the temporary garment that clothes the spirit, to be chosen according to the task in hand upon earth. Outward appearance does not matter. The soul within does. A great prophet may come in the guise of a pauper. How better can one judge of man's charity to man? While one who has sinned in a past life, when there is not poverty to drive him on. The wheel of life is what we call the act of being born, living on some world, dying, going back to the spirit state, and in time being reborn in different circumstances and conditions. A man may suffer much in a life. It does not necessarily mean that he was evil in a past life. It may be the best and quickest way of learning certain things. Practical experience is a better teacher than hearsay. One who commits suicide may be reborn to live out the years cut short in the past life, but it does not follow that all who die young, or as babies, were suicides. The wheel of life applies to all, beggars and kings, men and women, colored people and white. The wheel is but a symbol, of course, but one which makes matters clearer to those who have no time to make a long study of the subject. One cannot explain Tibetan belief in a paragraph or two. The Kangyur, or Tibetan scriptures, consist of over 100 books on the subject, and even then it is not fully dealt with. There are many books hidden within remote lamasaries which are seen by initiates alone. For centuries, people of the East have known of the various occult forces and laws, and that these were natural. Instead of trying to disprove such forces on the grounds that as they could not be weighed or tested with acids, they could not exist, Eastern scientists and researchers have striven to increase their command over these laws of nature. The mechanics of clairvoyance, for example, did not interest us. The results of clairvoyance did. Some people doubt clairvoyance. They are like the born blind who say that sight is impossible because they have not experienced it, because they cannot understand how an object some distance away can be seen when there is clearly no contact between it and the eyes. People have auras, colored outlines which surround the body, and by the intensity of those colors, those experienced in the art can deduce a person's health, integrity, and general state of evolution. The aura is the radiation of the inner life force, the ego or soul. Around the head is a halo or nimbus, which also is part of the force. At death, the light fades as the ego leaves the body on its journey to the next stage of existence. It becomes a ghost. It drifts a little, perhaps dazed by the sudden shock of being free of the body. It may not be fully aware of what is happening. That is why lamas attend the dying, that they may be informed of the stages through which they will pass. If this is neglected, the spirit may be earthbound by desires of the flesh. It is the duty of the priest to break these ties. At frequent intervals, we had a service for guiding the ghosts. Death has no terror for Tibetans, but we believe that one can have an easier passage from this life to the next if certain precautions are taken. It is necessary to follow clearly defined paths and to think along certain lines. The service would be conducted in a temple with about 300 monks present. In the center of the temple would be a group of perhaps 5 telepathic lamas sitting in a circle face to face. As the monks, led by an abbot, chanted, the lamas would try to maintain telepathic contact with distressed souls. No translation from the Tibetan prayers can do full justice to them, but here is an attempt. Hear the voices of our souls, all you who wander unguided in the borderlands. The living and the dead live in worlds apart. Where can their faces be seen and their voices heard? The first stick of incense is lit to summon a wandering ghost that he may be guided. Hear the voices of our souls, all you who wander. This is the world of illusion. Life is but a dream. All that are born must die. Only the way of Buddha leads to eternal life. The third stick of incense is lit to summon a wandering ghost that he may be guided. Hear the voices of our souls, all you of great power, you who have been enthroned with mountains and rivers under your rule. Your reigns have lasted but a moment, and the complaints of your people have never ceased. The earth runs with blood, and the leaves of the trees are swayed by the sighs of the oppressed. The fourth stick of incense is lit to summon the ghosts of kings and dictators that they may be guided. Hear the voices of our souls, all you warriors who have invaded, wounded, and killed. Where are your armies now? The earth groans and weeds grow over the battlefields. The fifth stick of incense is lit to summon lonely ghosts of generals and lords for guidance. Hear the voices of our souls, all artists and scholars, you who have worked at painting and writing. In vain you have strained your sight and worn down your ink slabs. Nothing of you is remembered, and your souls must continue on. The sixth stick of incense is lit to summon the ghosts of artists and scholars for guidance. Hear the voices of our souls, beautiful virgins and ladies of high degree, whose youth could be compared to a fresh spring morning. After the embrace of lovers comes the breaking of hearts. The autumn, then the winter, comes. Trees and flowers fade, as do beauty, and become but skeletons. The seventh stick of incense is lit to summon the wandering ghosts of virgins and ladies of high degree, that they may be guided away from the ties of the world. hear the voices of our souls, all beggars and thieves, and those who have committed crimes against others and who cannot now obtain rest. Your soul wanders friendless in the world, and you have not justice within you. The eighth stick of incense is lit to summon all ghosts who have sinned and who now wander alone. Hear the voices of our souls, prostitutes, women of the night, and all those that have been sinned against, and who now wander alone in ghostly realms. The ninth stick of incense is lit to summon them for guidance, that they may be freed from the bonds of the world. In the incense-laden dusk of the temple, the flickering butter lamps would cause living shadows to dance behind the golden images. The air would grow tense with the concentration of the telepathic monks as they strove to maintain contact with those who had passed from the world and yet were still bound to it. Russet-robed monks, sitting in lines facing each other, would intone the litany of the dead, and hidden drums would beat out the rhythm of the human heart. From other parts of the temple, as in the living body, would come the growling of internal organs, the rustling of body fluids, and the sigh of air in the lungs. As the ceremony continued with directions to those who had passed over, the tempo of the body sounds would change, become slow, until at last would come the sounds of the spirit leaving the body. A rustling, quavering gasp and silence. The silence that comes with death. Into that silence would come an awareness discernible to even the least psychic, that other things were around, waiting, listening. Gradually, as the telepathic instruction continued, the tension would lessen as the unquiet spirits moved on towards the next stage of their journey. We believe firmly that we are reborn time after time, but not merely to this earth. There are millions of worlds, and we know that most of them are inhabited. Those inhabitants may be in very different forms to those we know. They may be superior to humans. We in Tibet have never subscribed to the view that man is the highest and most noble form of evolution. We believe that much higher life forms are to be found elsewhere, and they do not drop atom bombs. In Tibet, I have seen records of strange craft in the skies. The chariots of the gods, most people called them. The Lama, Mingyar Dondup, told me that a group of lamas had established telepathic communications with these gods, who said that they were watching Earth, apparently in much the same way as humans watch wild and dangerous animals in a zoo. Much has been written about levitation. It is possible, as I have often seen it, but it takes much practice. There is no real point in engaging in levitation, as there is a far simpler system. Astral traveling is easier and surer. Most lamas do it, and anyone who is prepared to use some patience can indulge in the useful and pleasant art. During our waking hours on Earth, our ego is confined to the physical body. and unless one is trained, it is not possible to separate them. When we sleep, it is only the physical body which needs rest. The spirit disengages itself and usually goes to the spirit realm in much the same way as a child returns home at the end of the school day. The ego and physical bodies maintain contact by means of the silver cord, which is capable of unlimited extension. The body stays alive so long as the silver cord is intact. At death, the cord is severed as the spirit is born into another life in the spirit world, just as a baby's umbilical cord is severed to part it from its mother. Birth to a baby is death to the sheltered life it led within the mother's body. Death to the spirit is birth again into the freer world of spirit. While the silver cord is intact, the ego is free to roam during sleep, or consciously in the case of those specially trained. The roaming of the spirit produces dreams, which are impressions transmitted along the silver cord. As the physical mind receives them, they are rationalized to fit in with one's earth belief. In the world of spirit, there is no time. Time is a purely physical concept. And so we have cases where long and involved dreams seem to occur in the fraction of a second. Probably everyone has had a dream in which a person far away, perhaps across the oceans, has been met and spoken to. Some message may have been given, and on awakening, there is usually a strong impression of something that should be remembered. Frequently, there is the memory of meeting a distant friend or relative, and it is no surprise to hear from the person within a very short time. In those who are untrained, the memory is often distorted, and the result is an illogical dream or nightmare. In Tibet, we travel much by astral projection, not by levitation, and the whole process is within our control. The ego is made to leave the physical body, although still connected to it by the silver cord. One can travel where one wills as quickly as one can think. Most people have the ability to engage in astral travel. Many have actually started out and, being untrained, have experienced a shock. Probably everyone has had the sensation of just drifting off to sleep and then, without apparent reason, being violently awakened by a powerful, sudden jerk. This is caused by too rapid exteriorization of the ego, an ungentle parting of physical and astral bodies. It causes contraction of the silver cord, and the astral is snatched back into the physical vehicle. It is a much worse feeling when one has traveled and is returning. The astral is floating many feet above the body, like a balloon at the end of a string. Something, perhaps some external noise, causes the astral to return to the body with excessive rapidity. The body awakes suddenly, and there is the horrible feeling that one has fallen off a cliff and awakened just in time. Astral traveling under one's full control and while fully conscious can be accomplished by almost anyone. It needs practice, but above all, in the early stages, it demands privacy where one can be alone without fear of interruption. This is not a textbook of metaphysics, so there is no point in giving instructions on astral traveling, but it should be emphasized that it can be a disturbing experience unless one has a suitable teacher. There is no actual danger, but there is a risk of shocks and emotional disturbances if the astral body is allowed to leave or return to the physical out of phase or coincidence. People with heart weaknesses should never practice astral projection. While there is no danger in projection itself, there is grave danger to those with a weak heart if another person enters the room and disturbs the body or cord. The resulting shock could prove fatal, and this would be very inconvenient indeed, as the ego would have to be reborn to finish that particular span of life before it could proceed to the next stage. We Tibetans believe that everyone, before the fall of man, had the ability to travel in the astral, see by clairvoyance, telepathize, and levitate. Our version of that fall is that man abused the occult powers and used them for self-interest instead of for the development of mankind as a whole. In the earliest days, mankind could converse with mankind by telepathy. Local tribes had their own versions of vocal speech, which they used exclusively among themselves. The telepathic speech was, of course, by thought, and could be understood by all, regardless of local language. When the power of telepathy was lost through abuse, there was babble. We do not have a Sabbath day as such. Ours are holy days and are observed on the 8th and 15th of each month. Then there are special services, and the days are regarded as sacred, and no work is normally done. Our annual festivals, I have been told, correspond somewhat to the Christian festivals, but my knowledge of the latter is quite insufficient for me to comment. Our festivals are: first month, this corresponds roughly to February, from the first to the third day, we celebrate Lhag Sar. This, in the Western world, would be called New Year. It is a great occasion for games as well as religious services. Our greatest ceremony of the day is held from the 4th to the 15th day. These are the days of supplication. Our name for it is Mon Lam. This ceremony really is the highlight of the religious and secular year. On the 15th day of this same month, we have the anniversary of Buddha's conception. This is not a time for games, but one of solemn thanksgiving. To complete the month, we have, on the 27th, a celebration which is partly religious, partly mythical. It is the procession of the Holy Dagger. With that, the events of the first month are ended. The second month, which approximates to March, is fairly free of ceremony. On the 29th day, there is the chase and expulsion of the demon of ill luck. The third month, April, also has very few public ceremonies. On the 15th day, there is the anniversary of revelation. With the arrival of the 8th day of the fourth month, May, by the Western calendar, we celebrate the anniversary of Buddha's renunciation of the world. This, so far as I understand, is similar to the Christian Lent. We had to live even more austerely during the days of renunciation. The 15th day was the anniversary of Buddha's death. We regarded it as the anniversary of all those who had left this life. All Souls Day was another term for it. On that day, we burned our sticks of incense to call the spirits of those who wandered earthbound. It will be understood that these are merely the major festivals. There are many minor days which had to be marked and ceremonies attended, but which are not of sufficient importance to enumerate here. June was the month when on the fifth day we medical lamas had to attend special ceremonies at other lamasaries. The celebrations were of thanks for the ministrations of the medical monks, of which Buddha was the founder. On that day, we could do no wrong, but on the day after, we were certainly called to account for what our superiors imagined we had done. The anniversary of Buddha's birth came on the fourth day of the sixth month, July. Then also, we celebrated the first preaching of the law. Harvest Festival was on the eighth day of the eighth month, October. Because Tibet is an arid country, very dry, we depended upon the rivers to a much greater extent than in other countries. Rainfall was slight in Tibet, so we combined Harvest Festival with a water festival, as without water from the rivers, there would be no harvest from the land. The 22nd day of the 9th month, November, was the anniversary of Buddha's miraculous descent from heaven. The next month, the 10th, we celebrate the Feast of the Lamps on the 25th day. The final religious events of the year were on the 29th to 30th days of the 12th month, which is the junction of January and February according to the Western calendar. At this time, we had the expulsion of the old year and making ready for the new. Our calendar is very different indeed from the Western. We use a 60-year cycle, and each year is indicated by 12 animals and 5 elements in various combination. Our new year is in February. It is our belief that the probabilities of the future can be foretold. To us, divination, by whatever means, is a science and is accurate. We believe in astrology. To us, astrological influences are but cosmic rays which are colored or altered by the nature of the body reflecting them to Earth. Anyone will agree that one can have a camera and a white light and take a picture of something. By putting various filters over the camera lens or over the light, we can arrange for certain effects on the finished photograph. We can get orthochromatic, panchromatic, or infrared effects, to mention 3 out of a large number. People are affected in a similar way by the cosmic radiation impinging upon their own chemical and electrical personality. Buddha says, stargazing and astrology, forecasting lucky or unfortunate events by signs, prognosticating good or evil, all these things are forbidden. But a later decree in one of our sacred books says, that power which is given to the few by nature, and for which that individual endures pain and suffering, may be used. No psychic power may be used for personal gain, for worldly ambition, or as proof of the reality of such powers. Only thus can those not so gifted be protected. My attainment of the third eye had been painful, and it had increased the power with which I had been born. But in a later chapter we will return to the opening of third eye. Here is a good place to mention more of astrology and quote the names of three eminent Englishmen who have seen an astrological prophecy which came true. Since 1027, all major decisions in Tibet have been taken with the aid of astrology. The invasion of my country by the British in 1904 was accurately foretold. On page 109 of this book is a reproduction of the actual prophecy in the Tibetan language, and it reads, in the year of the wood dragon, the first part of the year protects the Dalai Lama. After that, fighting and quarreling robbers come forward. There are many enemies. Troublesome grief by weapons will arise, and the people will fight. At the end of the year, a conciliatory speaker will end the war. That was written before the year 1850 and concerns the year 1904, the Wood Dragon War. Colonel Younghusband was in charge of the British forces. He saw the prediction at Lhasa. A Mr. L. A. Waddell, also of the British Army, saw the printed prediction in the year 1902. Mr. Charles Bell, who later went to Lhasa, also saw it. Some other events which were accurately forecast were 1910, Chinese invasion of Tibet, 1911, Chinese revolution and formation of the nationalist government, late 1911, eviction of Chinese from Tibet, 1914, war between England and Germany, 1933, passing from this life of the Dalai Lama, 1935, return of a fresh incarnation of the Dalai Lama, 1950, evil forces would invade Tibet. The communists invaded Tibet in October 1950. Mr. Bell, later Sir Charles Bell, saw all those predictions in Lhasa. In my own case, everything foretold about me has come true, especially the hardships. The science, for science it is, of preparing a horoscope is not one which can be dealt with in a few pages of a book of this nature. Briefly, it consists of preparing a map of the heavens as they were at the time of conception and at the time of birth. The exact hour of birth has to be known, and that time has to be translated into star time, which is quite different from all the zone times of the world. as the speed of the Earth in its orbit is 19 miles a second, it will be seen that inaccuracy will make a tremendous difference. At the equator, the rotation of the Earth is about 1,040 miles an hour. The world is tilted as it rolls, and the North Pole is about 3,100 miles ahead of the South Pole in the autumn, but in spring the position is reversed. The longitude of the place of birth thus is of vital importance. When the maps are prepared, those with the necessary training can interpret their meanings. The interrelationships of each and every planet has to be assessed, and the effect on the particular map calculated. We prepare a conception chart to know the influences in force during the very first moments of a person's existence. The birth map indicates the influences at force at the moment the individual enters upon an unsuspecting world. To know of the future, we prepare a map of the time for which it is desired to have the reading and compare it with the natal chart. Some people say, but can you really predict who is going to win the 230? The answer is no, not without casting the horoscope for every man, horse, and horse owner concerned in the race. Closed eyes and a pin jabbing the starting list is the best method here. We can tell if a person will recover from an illness, or if Tom will marry Lucy and live happily ever afterwards, but that deals with individuals. We can also say that if England and America do not check communism, a war will start in the year of the Wood Dragon, which in this cycle is 1964. Then in that case, at the end of the century, there should be an attractive fireworks display to entertain any observers on Mars or Venus, assuming that the communists remain unchecked. A further point, which often seems to puzzle those of the Western world, is the question of tracing one's past lives. People who have no skill in the matter say that it cannot be done, just as a totally deaf man might say, I hear no sound, therefore there is no sound. It is possible to trace previous lives. It takes time, much working out of charts and calculations. A person may stand at an airport and wonder about the last calls of arriving aircraft. The onlookers perhaps can make a guess, but the control tower staff, with their specialized knowledge, can say. If an ordinary sightseer has a list of aircraft registration letters and numbers and a good timetable, he may be able to work out the ports of call himself. So can we with past lives. It would need a complete book at least to make the process clear, and so it would be useless to delve more deeply now. It may be of interest to say what points Tibetan astrology covers. We use 19 symbols in the house of astrology. Those symbols indicate personality and self-interest, finances, how one can gain or lose money, relations, short journeys, mental and writing ability, property and the conditions at the close of life, children, pleasures and speculations, illness, work and small animals, partnerships, marriage, enemies, lawsuits, legacies, long journeys and psychic matters, profession and honors, friendships and ambitions, troubles, restraints, and occult sorrows. We can also tell the approximate time or under what conditions the following incidents will occur. Love, the type of person and the time of meeting. Marriage, when and how it will work out. Passion, the furious temper kind. Catastrophe and how it will occur or if it will. Fatality, death, when and how. Prison or other forms of restraint. Discord, usually family or business quarrels. Spirit, the stage of evolution reached. Although I do astrology quite a lot, I find psychometry and crystal gazing much more rapid and no whit less accurate. It is also easier when one is bad at figures. Psychometry is the art of picking up faint impressions of past events from an article. Everyone has this ability to some extent. People enter an old church or temple, hallowed by the passing years, and will say, "What a calm, soothing atmosphere." But the same people will visit the site of a gruesome murder and exclaim, "Oh, I don't like it here. It's eerie. Let's get out." Crystal gazing is somewhat different. The glass, as mentioned above, is merely a focus for the rays from the third eye, in much the same way as X-rays are brought to focus on a screen and show a fluorescent picture. There is no magic at all involved. It is merely a matter of utilizing natural laws. In Tibet, we have monuments to natural laws. Our chortens, which range in size from 5 feet to 50 feet high, are symbols which compare with the crucifix or icon. All over Tibet, these chortens stand. On the sketch map of Lhasa, 5 are shown. The Pargo Kaling is the largest and is one of the gates of the city. Chortens are always of the shape shown in the illustration below in this book. The square indicates the solid foundation of the earth. Upon it rests a globe of water, surrounded by a cone of fire. Above this is a saucer of air, and higher, the wavering spirit or ether, which is waiting to leave the world of materialism. Each element is reached by the steps of attainment. The whole thing symbolizes the Tibetan belief. We come to earth when we are born. During our life we climb upwards, or try to, by way of the steps of attainment. Eventually our breath fails and we enter into the spirit. Then, after a varying interval, we are reborn to learn another lesson. The wheel of life symbolizes the endless round of birth, life, death, spirit, birth, life, and so on. Many ardent students make the serious mistake of thinking that we believe in these horrid hells, sometimes pictured on the wheel. A few illiterate savages may, but not those who have received enlightenment. Do Christians really believe that when they die, Satan and company gets busy with the roasting and racking? Do they believe that if they go to the other place, being one of the minority, they sit on a cloud in a nightshirt and take lessons in harp playing? We believe that we learn on earth, and that on Earth we get our roasting and racking. The other place, to us, is where we go when out of the body, where we can meet entities who are also out of the body. This is not spiritualism. It is instead a belief that during sleep or after death, we are free to wander in astral planes. Our own term for the higher reaches of these planes is the land of the golden light. We are sure that when we are in the astral, after death, or when asleep, we can meet those we love because we are in harmony with them. We cannot meet those we dislike because that would be a state of disharmony, and such conditions cannot exist in the land of the golden light. All these things have been proved by time, and it does seem rather a pity that Western doubt and materialism have prevented the science from being properly investigated. Too many things have been scoffed at in the past and then proved right by the passage of the years. Telephones, radio, television, flying, and many more. End of chapter 10.